we're doing today. So, we got a good weather day in Cleveland. We were standing outside just talking with everyone about how beautiful it is today. So, after this, you can go enjoy that because we don't get too many of those here. So, what we're talking about today is, to be frank, tough. This is kind of one of those passages that when people talk about the Bible, especially those who are critical, they point to a passage like the flood, and they say, this is why I can't trust a God. I can't trust a God who would wipe out people. I can't trust a God who would commit murder or whatever. And so what I'm trying to do today is convince you that you can trust this God. That there's a lot more going on here in this story than we actually see. And yet to get there, we have to start at the very beginning, right? So if you're new to us, if this is your first time here, welcome. My name is Pastor Jesse. I'm one of the pastors here at City View. And this summer, we are doing a daunting task of trying to walk through the law or the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible we're trying to walk through. And obviously, if we went verse by verse, we wouldn't be able to be here. We wouldn't be able to do that in the summer. We would be here for about 5 years, right? And so we are doing an overview of the first five books of the Bible. We'd be here for a long time as well today. So first of all, we started off in a little bit different than we maybe have heard about it. We read this Hebrew poem that described who God is and that we can trust him. We saw that we as humans are made in the image of God, and because we are made in the image of God, we have worth, value, and beauty. And God said that everything in creation was good, but he said that humans were very good. And then, pretty quickly, there's a problem. And Pastor Caleb walked us through what we oftentimes call the fall, where humanity, the images of God, were tricked. They were tricked by a serpent. So in one sense, they were tricked by an animal who they were supposed to rule over. They were ultimately ruled over by that serpent. But we also find that it wasn't simply just a serpent, that there was something deeper and darker about this serpent. And later biblical authors will call that serpent the great adversary or the devil or the accuser. And the plot thickens because humans, instead of trusting God, instead of trusting that they can get everything they need from God, instead of trusting that God is good, they try to act like God themselves and obtain knowledge and wisdom on their own. And the result, as Pastor Caleb talked about, was death. Death entered this world for humans and for creation. And yet we're not left there. There's this beautiful passage in the midst of the curse. So God is going to curse humanity. God is going to curse the land. He's going to curse things that he created. And yet, in the midst of that curse, there's this hope. There's this promise that one day that great adversary would be dealt with. That one day a human would come from the line of Eve. That she would bear a son, and that son would crush the head of the serpent. And the rest of the Bible is looking for that head crusher. And then last week, Pastor Bill walked us through the next story. And that story is about two brothers, Cain and Abel. And the crazy thing is that the Genesis 4 starts off with this beautiful song by Eve saying, "Thank God I've produced an offspring, or I've produced a seed through the help of God," like she's hoping that Cain would be the head crusher who would crush a serpent. And yet quickly we find out that he's actually the one who crushes his brother's head, not the head of the serpent. And there's this passage in verse 10 of chapter 4 that says, the blood of Abel cries out to God. And I want you to hold on to that for a second. Because we're going to try to answer throughout the entire series, but we are going to try to answer, who is this God? And the first hint that we got from chapter 4 was, this God is someone who listens to the cry of the vulnerable. That he listens to the blood cry out from Abel. And he cares so much about his people that when injustice happens, God will act. And God showed up on the scene, and in an act of justice and mercy, God condemns Cain and saves Cain in the same chapter. But what we see is a spiral happen. That humanity stops acting like Abel and pleasing God and starts acting like Cain. And not only not pleasing God, but killing the innocent and spilling the blood. And we are introduced over and over again, if you read between chapters 4 and 6 where we're going to start. Chapter 5 is all about all of these people who are evil in the sight of God. And that's where we're at here in chapter 6. But before we do that, I want to go over one thing. We're in church. This flood story is not unique to the Bible. There are many different flood stories. If you go and Google how many flood stories are, there's going to be a ton of Wikipedia articles on different flood stories. And even in that region, there's 5 different flood stories. And yet, I want to focus on 2. The first is in Egypt, right? We talked way back at the beginning of this section, we talked about how this is written to people coming out of slavery. So Genesis is written to slaves coming out of Egypt. And so they would have been very familiar with the culture of Egypt. And they would have been very familiar with the stories of Egypt and the myths of Egypt. And in Egypt, there was a flood story. And what that flood story said was that the sun god Ra was pretty angry because humans were unfaithful. That's all it says. So he commissions his daughter. And his daughter goes around and is slaughtering humans via a flood. And she becomes so bloodthirsty that she starts killing more humans than Ra wanted her to kill. So Ra comes up with this plan to turn beer, they dye beer so it looks like blood, so that she drinks enough beer and becomes intoxicated and stops killing humans. That's the flood story. It's deeper than that, but that's how much time we have. That's the overview. So what does that show? If you're going to ask these same questions, who is that God? We actually see that Ra, in that culture, would have been a god who couldn't even control his own daughter. This other god, this goddess, his daughter, is a bloodthirsty tyrant, almost, who wants to kill humanity. And so this flood story does not elevate who God is, but it almost makes you fear. And the next one we're going to go through is actually from the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is something that we found on tablets, and it was around this very same time. And the reason why that god decided to kill humanity was because they were too loud. He wanted to sleep. And so he decided he was just going to kill them, wipe them off the face of the earth, because they were too ruckus. Now, how many of you guys have ever had a loud neighbor? Right? I really relate to this story from the Epic of Gilgamesh. Because a couple Sundays ago, we We're trying to sleep, and all of a sudden our neighbor put a dog out at 2 o'clock in the morning, and it barked until I left at 7:30. So, like, I understand wanting to sleep, and yet that's not the God I serve. So, how we're going to frame this? We kind of saw some of the other flood stories in that culture. When we ask questions like, oh, did the flood happen, or how did the flood happen, we're not asking the questions that the author wants us to ask. No other culture asked that at this time. Everyone assumed that a flood happened. But what the author is trying to show us, what Moses, as he writes this to the people coming out of slavery, is he wants them to see that this God of the Bible is very, very different than the gods of Egypt. And this God of the Bible is very, very different than the gods of Mesopotamia. And this God is actually a God, not of vengeance, but a God of justice and mercy. See, what we're going to see in this flood story is it's not simply God wanting to wipe out humanity because they're too loud. It's a God who seeks justice. And he brings about justice, but he also cares about mercy. And he cares about redemption. So that's what we're going to try to look at through 4 chapters. Promise I won't read it all. What I want us to see, or what I want us to answer, is this question: who is God? And then the answer is, or I want to ask the question, can we trust him? I don't know about you. I can't trust a God who doesn't have control over his own daughter. I can't trust a God who gets so bloodthirsty she gets out of control. I can't trust a God that is so worried about his own sleep and his own well-being that he would be willing to kill humanity. But the question is, can I trust Yahweh? Can I trust the God of the Bible? And before we get into that, we got to pray, because that's a big ask. So let's pray. Dear Lord, just thank you that you are not Ra. Lord, thank you that you are not the God of other cultures, but you are the God who sees me, as Hagar says. That you are a God who cares. That you are a God who hears the cries and hears the blood spilled and does not turn his back on the innocent. Amen. So we're going to start in chapter 6 of Genesis. And we're going to start in the first verse. And we're going to walk through for a while. And then I'm going to jump ahead. And I want a little caveat. Just because I'm jumping ahead does not mean that's not important. I would love for you, my dream would be that you go back and read every verse from 6 to 9, because I don't have time to cover it all. It's all important, but I want to highlight a few things here as we go. So starting in chapter 6, verse 1, it says this: when mankind began to multiply on the earth and the daughters were born to them. Stop. Is that wrong? Is that what they're supposed to do? That's the commission they were given in Genesis 1, is multiply on the earth. So verse 1 is living out your commission. Have children. That's what Adam and Eve were told to do. And yet now it goes bad. They were beautiful, and they took, and they will not remain with mankind forever, because they are corrupt. Their days will be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth both in those days and afterwards, when the sons of God came to the daughters of mankind who bore children to them. They were powerful men of old, the famous men. Pretty weird start, huh? we see this idea where these spiritual beings come down and intermix with humans, and all of a sudden there's these great warriors. If you follow the Nephilim throughout, it's these great warriors who are all about violence and killing and all this stuff. And God looks at them and he says, man, that's bad. And you may be like, Pastor Jesse, I thought we were jumping around. Why did you start here? This is really weird. And there's a lot here. And it is weird. And I don't have time to explain all of it. And yet there's one thing, and I highlighted it for you, that we need to see all throughout the Bible, is there is this pattern that started in Genesis chapter 3 when Eve saw the fruit and she took it. Because every time you see a human see something and take it for themselves, you now know that that's bad. And that something bad is about to happen. And so we see right off the bat here in chapter 6 that the sons of God came down and took the daughters of man, or they saw and took them. And I don't know exactly what that looks like. There's a lot of arguments, and yet humanity was corrupted again. In the garden, a spiritual being came down and convinced humanity to take the fruit. And again, we see this pattern. Sons of God, some spiritual being, something's going on here that comes down and actually convinces humans to not trust God, but to trust themselves, and leads to a bunch of violence. We're going to keep reading. When the Lord saw that human wickedness was widespread on the earth and that every inclination of the human mind was nothing but evil all the time, the Lord regretted that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved. Then the Lord said, I will wipe out mankind whom I created off the face of the earth, together with the animals, creatures that crawl, birds of the sky, for I regret that I made them. However, Noah found favor in God's eyes. This word wickedness is going to be tied to wickedness later on, which is all about violence. How many of you guys watch the news? And I feel like recently it's just all been about violence and death and chaos, and all of this stuff is going on. That's what was going on then too. See, the picture that you should see as you're reading this is that the whole mass of humanity is acting like Cain, that they are killing the innocent, that the innocent blood is crying out to God, and our God hears us. And so when God surveys the whole land, when God's Spirit comes out and looks over the whole land, he sees the creation is tainted, because creation is killing the innocent. Human blood is being spilled. Justice does not reign. Unfortunately, the 20th century was one of the most bloodiest centuries in history. And those who are quick to point out how wicked God is in chapter 6 and the flood story, I wonder if they would say that about all of the genocide that happened. Right? When you step in to bring justice on bloodshed of the innocent, you're not wicked. You're just. How many of them would think that it would be warranted to stop bloodshed by killing those who are killing the innocent? They probably would, right? It is not a wicked God who wipes out those who are doing evil atrocities, right? It's ultimately a good God. And yet, there's one who finds favor with God. That as God surveys the land, he finds favor with Noah. That Noah is not like the rest. That Noah is someone who cares for people. And God sees him. And we're going to keep reading. This is God speaking to Noah, verse 17. Again, the rest that we just skipped, it's very important, but read it yourself, please. 17. Understand that I am bringing a flood. Flood waters on the earth to destroy every creature under heaven with the breath of life in it. Everything on earth will perish, but I will establish my covenant with you and your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives. You will also bring into the ark two of all the living creatures, male and female, to keep them alive with you. Two of everything, from the birds according to their kinds, from the livestock according to their kinds, and the animals that crawl on the earth according to their kinds, will come with you so that you keep them alive. Take with you every kind of food that is eaten. Gather it as food for you and for them. And Noah did this. He did everything that God commanded. So the first thing that we see, if you're taking notes, we see that mankind is corrupt. And it's not just that they're annoying, or that they're unruly, or that they're loud. It's that they're violent. And they're killing innocent blood. And it seems that everyone is. That the norm is not Abel, but the norm is Cain. And there's only one exception to that, and it's Noah's family. And so when God looks down, he says, I need to start over. And so in one sense, and we're going to get into this in a second, the flood is actually portrayed in this as decreation. Right? Chapter 1 was all about creation, and the flood's actually going to reverse all of that was created, and the flood is actually decreation. So God comes to Noah and he tells him, why don't you build? And the word he uses here is ark. Now, if you were to picture ark, what would you guys picture? A boat, right? A big boat that looks like a boat, that's tall. And you know what? There's one problem with that picture. And we didn't read it. It is important, but this is why I'm going over it. What they tell him is not a boat. And actually, the word ark does not mean boat. The actual closest definition to ark is basket. And we're going to see actually the word ark used later on in Exodus when Moses is put in an ark. It's the same word. It's actually an Egyptian word. And it means basket. And it usually looks like a big floating box. Now, we have some people here from South Florida, right? I'm not going to point out who they are. But I'm sure that those who are from Florida have seen boats before, right? Right? We're in Ohio, we see boats. And one thing that a boat needs is it needs some way to steer and it needs some way to move. And yet when Noah is given directions how to build this boat, he's not given a sail. He's not given a rudder. He's not given oars. He's not given a steering wheel. There's no way for Noah to actually control this boat. And it really is probably not like a boat that we would see. When the original audience heard this, because in an oral tradition they heard it read, they would have thought basket. Or actually what they probably would have thought was in Egypt. They used to put idols in. And what is an idol? City, they would send it down the Nile in an ark so that it was preserved and not destroyed by ago. What does the author of Genesis want you to know about humans? They are the image of God. So this ark, written to people coming out of Egypt, he uses that word. He doesn't use boat. Boat would make a lot more sense, and there's a Hebrew word for boat, and he doesn't use it. He uses an Egyptian word that represents a carrier of the image of God. The ark is Eden. Right, the ark is supposed to make you think of Eden. In the midst of chaos, there's a place where humans survive. And it says repetitively, he brings every animal, male and female, every animal, male and female, of their kind, crawling, and all of it. You're supposed to go back to Eden. And what is the picture of Eden? Is that God cares so much for his image that he will preserve his image. Not a God who is vengeful. Not a God who looks to wipe out humanity because they're too loud. But a God who cares so much for his people that he will save a remnant from the justice. That he will save the righteous from the oncoming flood. The ark is Eden. And yet we got to get into the creation. We're going to go down to chapter 1, or chapter 7, verse 1. Verse 11, I'm sorry. I'm jumping around too much for myself. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day, the sources of the vast watery depths burst open, and the floodgates of the sky were open. What does God do on day two? But he separates and he holds back the vast waters of the sky, and he separates water from water. And what does he do here in decreation? But he opens that floodgates. There's no longer a difference between water from above and water below. It's all there. The water from up comes down and the water below rises. It's decreation. And the rain fell on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. On the same day, Noah, along with his sons Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's wife and their three sons' wives, entered the ark with him. They entered with all the wildlife according to their kinds, all the livestock according to their kinds, and all creatures that crawl on the earth according to their kinds, every flying creature, all the birds, and every wind. And yet it's hitting a point that this is two of every creature that has breath on its life, of life in it, came to Noah and entered the ark. Those that entered, male and female, of every creature, entered just as God had commanded him. Then the Lord shut him in. We're told that Noah was righteous. We're told that Noah listen to God. And so what does it mean to be righteous? But to trust God and to obey God. And what do we see? That is what Noah did. The flood continued for 40 days on the earth. The water increased and lift the ark so that it rose above the earth. The water surged and increased on the face of the earth, or greatly on the earth. And the ark floated on the surface of the water. Noah didn't steer the ark. It floated. Noah trusted that God would save and that God would provide. He didn't need to steer it. Every creature perished. Those that crawl on the earth, birds, livestock, wildlife, and those who swarm on the earth, as well as all mankind, everything with the breath of the spirit of life in its nostrils. Everything on dry land died. He wiped out every living thing that was on the face of the earth, from mankind to livestock, to creatures that crawl, to the birds of the sky, and they wiped off the face of the earth. Only Noah was left and those with him in the ark, and the water surged on the earth for 150 days. On day three, God filled, or on day six, God filled the land. On day three, God created the land. On day six, God filled the land. And the land ended up being filled with violence and corruption and evil. And so what does God do? He wipes it out, which is the opposite. And then the land disappears, and all there is chaotic waters. And we're kind of brought back to the beginning of Genesis 1, when the Spirit of God hovered over the chaotic waters. You see it? You see, like, the poetry? Like, it's supposed to make you think of Genesis 1 kind of in reverse. So what would we then think, right? If this is a God who is loving, if this is a God who cares about his image and he created the world and said it was good, and now when corruption happened and it was no longer good, he decreated his world, what would you then expect to happen? Recreation, right? We start over. And if, I don't know about you, if I was God, which we're all very grateful I'm not. Well, it's not a joke. Right, if I was God, I would kind of start over with not do with humans again. I'd be like, man, these humans, they look like me, but they surely don't act like me. And that's not the God I serve, so thank God I'm not God. Because God said, I'm committed to humans. This is a God who cares about what he says. This is not a God who says one thing and then does another, but this is a God who is committed to his promises. And all the way back in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, he says, through the seed of the woman, I will redeem. I'm going to crush the head of the serpent. And so he cannot get rid of humanity completely because he cares about humans and he cares about his promise and he through a human, I guess. And so what do we see? Verse 1 of chapter 8. God remembered Noah. God remembered Noah. Very good news that God remembers his promises, that God remembers the righteous, that God remembers the faithful. Very good news. As well as all the wildlife and all the livestock that were with him in the ark. God caused a wind to pass over the earth. Not a great, I don't love that word because in Hebrew the word spirit and wind are the same word. It's ruach. And the ruach of God passed over and blew. And so if you are reading along and you look at Genesis chapter 1, the first thing that hovers over the waters, the chaotic waters, is the Spirit of God. And we see that creation is going to start again because once again the Spirit of God or the ruach of God is over the waters. And he's about to make things happen. The sources of the watery depths and the floodgates of the sky were closed. Water was separated from water. We see day two happen again. The water steadily receded from the earth, and by the end of 150 days, the water had decreased significantly. The ark came to rest in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, and on the mountains of Ararat. So what do we see in creation? We see a pattern. Day one separates light and dark. Day two separates water from water. Day three separates land from water. Day four, he fills the skies with the sun and the moon, and light now is filled. Day five, he fills the water. Day six, he fills the land. Decreation. God wipes out those that he filled on the land because they were corrupt and evil and they were filled, same word being used over and over again, with corruption. So what is he going to do? But then separate again. He separates the water and now the land. And because of the little Eden that's floating on top of the water, he once again will fill those things. The land will once again be filled. And we don't have time to read all about that because we don't have time. So you got to read the rest of chapter 8. on your own. Well, some of chapter 8. I'll read 15. But then we get to chapter 15. And God speaks again. Or verse 15. And God speaks again. After God has created, again, he speaks and he says this. The Lord spoke to Noah. By the way, it says, if you guys were here, one of the main focuses in Genesis chapter 1 is that God rests, therefore you can rest. Right? Day 7 is all about God resting, and kind of the good thing that we get to know about that is that because God rests, so can you, and he's writing that to a bunch of slaves who didn't even know what rest was. Right? And so what would you expect is that the ark rested. So we see that just even the words here used, and funny thing is Noah's name means rest, by the way. If you look up what does Noah's mean in Hebrew, it's rest. Then God said to Noah, come out of the ark, you, your wife, your sons' wives with you. Bring out all the living creatures that are with you, birds, livestock, those that crawl on the earth, and they will spread over the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth. So Noah, along with his sons, his wife, his sons' wives, came out. All the animals, all the creatures that crawl, and all the flying creatures, everything that moves on the earth, came out of the ark by their families. Anyone else kind of annoyed by how they say that? Like, can we just not say everyone came out of the ark? And yet there's a point here. This is an oral culture. Most people couldn't read. And so what's going on is someone gets up here, someone who could read would say this, and as you read all of Genesis, it should stick in your ear over and over and over again that the same words used here in Genesis 6 are the same words used in Genesis 1 and 2. That it's creation happening all over again. That the same call that Adam and Eve were given, which is go out and spread, go be fruitful and multiply, is also being told to Noah, go out and have dominion over this earth. Verse 20, then Noah built an altar to the Lord. He took some of every kind of clean animal and every kind of clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. When the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, he said to himself, I will never again curse the ground because of human beings. Even though, and I will never again strike down every living thing as I have done, as long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, and day and night will not cease. God looks and he says, hey guys, you kind of messed up. But I will not do this again. No, I'm committed not only to humans, but I'm committed to you and your family. And you're going to mess up. And your heart is full of evil. And even though the inclination of the human heart is evil, I will not give up on you. That we're now going to deal with the human heart. There will not be decreation and recreation on this scale. Noah, I promise you, because I'm a God of mercy. Verse 1 of chapter 9, God blessed Noah and his sons, and he said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And the fear and terror of you will be in every living creature on the earth, every bird of the sky, every creature that crawls on the ground, and all the fish of the sea. You're going to rule over them just like Adam was supposed to rule. You're going to rule over them, Noah. Every creature that lives and moves will be found, will be food for you, and I give the green plants. I have given you everything. However, you must not eat meat with its lifeblood in it. I will require it from any animal and from any human, if someone murders a fellow human, I will require that person's life. Order to happen to those who are innocent. God's still listening for the blood that cries out. He still cares for Abel. Whoever sheds human blood, by humans his blood will be shed. Why? For God made humans in his image. Your life matters because you are made in the image of God. But you, be fruitful and multiply, spread out over the earth and multiply on it. Then God said to Noah and his sons with him, understand that I am establishing my covenant with you and your descendants after you and with every living creature that is with you, birds, livestock, and all wildlife on the earth that are with you. All the animals of the earth that came out of the ark, I will establish my covenant with you that never again will every creature be wiped off out by floodwaters. There will never again be a flood to destroy the earth. You can trust me. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant I am making between me and you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all future generations. I have placed my bow in the clouds, and it will be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. One sec here. There's this, we don't talk like this, by the way. When was the last time you walked up to someone, hey, let me make a covenant with you? Like, we understand what that word kind of means, but we don't use it very much. And yet in this time, it was very, very common. And what a covenant was oftentimes something called a suzerain vassal covenant. So what that means is that someone who was powerful, so usually a nation, right? Let's use Egypt because they did this a lot. Egypt was a very powerful nation with the strongest army at that time. And so a much smaller nation was under attack by another smaller nation. And so what would happen is that smaller nation would go to Egypt and say, if we give you so much gold every year, will you protect us from our neighbor? And they enter in this covenant, and what Egypt would do is they would give them some sort of sign as a receipt for that covenant. So when said nation were to come and attack, they could bring that receipt to Egypt and say, here's the receipt, you promised to do it, and see, we've paid all of our gold. And then Egypt would come and destroy this nation. If the smaller nation did not pay their terms, right? If they didn't give enough gold or they didn't give gold that time, Egypt would then take back that receipt, and if that nation attacked, they'd be on their own. Or worse, Egypt would come and attack them themselves. Right? Suzerain vassal covenant. Suzerain's the powerful, the vassal's the not powerful. There's one that is powerful, there's one that is not powerful. The least powerful one had to live up to the protection. You know what's really weird about this one? We know who the suzerain is. It's God. But he does not require anything for his protection. That there is no giving. That he does not say, if you stop killing or if you stop being wicked, I will not destroy you. He actually says, even when you are wicked, even when you don't live up to the covenant, guess what, Noah? You're not going to do it, and I will still protect you, and you can see my covenant written in the sky because you can't lose it. See, that receipt that God is trustworthy is up in the sky. And there is no word here for rainbow. It just says bow. And if you were an ancient person, you would understand what a bow was. It's a weapon that when it's pointed at you, it's very dangerous. And yet, where is the rainbow pointing? Away from them. That we serve a God who cares so much about humans that he's not even going to require them to fulfill their end of the bargain. That I will protect you. I will not destroy you. I am not like the Mesopotamian gods who care about you being quiet, because I'm not like that. See, I have my wrath. I can rest from my judgment as well. See, in Egypt, the gods could easily get out of control, and yet God is not like that God. I have placed my bow in the clouds, and it will be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I form a cloud over the earth, and the bow appears in the clouds, I remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures. Water will never again become a flood to destroy everything. The bow will be in the clouds, and I will look at it and remember the permanent covenant between God and all living creatures on the earth. God said to Noah, "This is the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and every creature on earth." It's a little bit different. It's a little bit different than a vengeful God. It's absolutely a God who cares about justice. It is a God who does not sit back and watch creation undo itself. He kind of sped up the undoing, but he saved creation in the midst of speeding up the undoing. See, kind of the picture in Hebrew is not that is that God looked at humanity and said, they're going to kill themselves off. And if I don't step in and save some of them, they're all going to kill themselves off. So we actually see a God who cares about justice and mercy. A God who listens to the cry of the innocent, who cares about the blood spilled of the innocent. And if you kept reading in Genesis here, you're right now you think Noah's this awesome guy, and you read and he makes the exact same mistake that everyone else made. And we're not getting into that. There's a lot of explanations. Read it. Come up. Think what you think about what happens exactly. Something weird happens in his tent. But here's the thing. He goes out. He plants a garden, which is probably what he should do, right? And yet, he's supposed to rule over creation, and yet he plants a vineyard and gets drunk off of that creation. He doesn't rule over creation. He lets creation rule him. And then something happens with his kids in his tent, and you can read about it, and it's weird, and I don't know exactly what happened. And yet we see that Noah is also not as righteous as God said he was. And that should kind of give us hope, because if you trace the whole Bible story, everyone's kind of righteous and then not. Like, all these biblical characters have all these moments where you're like, holy crap, David is a man after God's own heart. Is he the one who's going to crush the head of the serpent? And then he doesn't. He becomes a serpent. And he sees Bathsheba and he takes her and then kills her husband. He becomes everything that's bad in Genesis 3 and 4 is David. But then we're introduced, and I promise we're closing here, to one guy named Jesus. And Jesus faces the same temptation, but he doesn't take it. He doesn't see and take, he rejects it. The devil talks to him and says, why don't you take that for your own? And he says, no, I trust in God. And he lives the life that we all should have lived. And in one sense, he is Adam. In one sense, he is Noah. In one sense, he is Moses. In one sense, he is Abraham. All of the people in the Bible, he is in one sense like them, but he's better. And then he dies. In Matthew chapter 27, this is where we're going to end. Here's Jesus cry out. 27 verse 45. From noon until 3 in the afternoon, darkness came over the whole land.
And about 3 p.m, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani?" That is, my God, why have you abandoned me?" See, the innocent blood cries out again. See, Eve way back in chapter 4 said, "I've had Cain. The prophecy is going to be fulfilled," and yet she's gravely disappointed. And yet one thing that's kind of cool is it's actually Abel's blood is the portrait of salvation. Because God once again hears the cry of the innocent's blood. He hears Jesus dying on the cross, and he responds with justice and mercy. That when Jesus died on the cross, God's fulfillment of justice and mercy was there, because Jesus bore the sin of humanity. Jesus was paying the price for the wicked who died in the flood. See, there was a flood of God's wrath in that moment, but it wasn't on all of humanity. It was on Jesus, the perfect, innocent one, the Abel picture in the story. And it's through his blood that redemption happens. So, I ask a question. Who is this God? Is it a God of wrath? Is it a God who can't control his bloodthirst? Is it a God who is so sleepy he kills humans so he can sleep better? Or is it something different? Is he someone who cares so much about righteousness that even when humans corrupt it, he takes care of it? When genocide is happening, he doesn't sit back. He takes care of the problems, but there's a remnant that he saves his image in the little box, the little ark, the little Eden. And he keeps it above the chaotic waters until there's rest. Is this the God who says, no matter what happens, no matter how wicked you are, no matter how bad humanity gets, I'm not going to do this again. See, my wrath will pour out, and there's stories of God's wrath. But the big wrath of God pouring out is on Jesus. I'm going to pour my wrath out, but I'm actually going to pour it out on the only innocent one. And through his blood, salvation will be obtained. Do you trust him? See, Noah trusted God. Noah was righteous when he trusted God. Abraham was called righteous when he trusted God. Do you trust Jesus? There's no innocent people in the story of Noah, but there is an innocent person in the story of Jesus. And he paid the price for you. I'm just as wicked. But do you trust him? Do you put your hope and faith in him? Because this Jesus didn't just stay dead, but he rose again and is living right now, and that's our good news. Let's pray. Dear Lord, just thank you that in the midst of stories that are really scary, that we see a God who is just. Thank you, you're just, but also a God who is merciful. So Lord, we pray all of that in Jesus' name. Amen.